Oceanus is an autonomous research ship that will operate without a crew and cruise the mid-Atlantic from the very, very northern reaches to the very, very south, collecting climatological and oceanographic data.
There's an opportunity to revolutionize marine science, revolutionize oceanography.
The Oceanus will be able to access areas that we can't currently get to.
And also to democratize it and actually give far more people access to the data and the opportunity to make measurements at sea.
Oceanus will be able to sample when we cannot physically get out to sample because the weather's too extreme. It would be really interesting to understand how the plankton are coping with these stormy events.
So the project is sustainable in that almost all the materials are recyclable, so it'll be aluminum. The fuel itself, hydrogenated vegetable oil, is basically a waste oil or made from plant product with very little, if any, emission from the ship when it's operating at sea.
For nearly 25 years now, we've been running an expedition called the Atlantic Meridional Transect, or the AMT for short.
It's a project that's been running since 1995. We run a series of expeditions between the UK and the South Atlantic. I think the excitement with autonomy is the actual scale that can be covered in terms of time and space that we can't do with a ship.
Autonomy and autonomous capability is a key to the future of marine science. For the same cost as a large research vessel, we could have a whole swarm, a whole fleet of these autonomous vessels operating throughout the world's oceans.
Guardian AI is marine AI's software that provides capability for object detection and hazard avoidance. And we'll be looking even further ahead than we were during the Mayflower project. We're able to assess far more complex incidents at sea, processing multi-ship coral reg scenarios.
The ocean is under continuous stresses from multiple points of view, from ocean acidification, marine plastics, pollution, global warming. And it's about how we monitor the world's oceans and how we can manage that changes and understand the speed at which those changes are occurring so that we can manage them and keep the oceans in a healthy condition for future generations.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Yacht Crew Vlogs right here on Yachting International Radio. My name is Rhea. I am your host, and I'm very pleased to welcome my next guest. First off, we have Icarus Allen. He is with the Plymouth Marine Laboratory. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we have Brett Finouche. He is, as well, part of this upcoming project. Welcome, Brett.
Thank you.
We're here today to talk about Project Oceanus. It is the world's first long-range autonomous research vessel. Tell us a little bit about that. Where did the name come from, Brett? Can you give us a little bit of history on it?
Sure. I can give you a couple of little. There's two really tracks for that. So the Mayflower autonomous ship that we built in across the ocean in 2022. Post-COVID, we were delayed, but it went across the Atlantic Ocean. Was the instigation for the next thing. So where do we go from Mayflower and something larger, something more capable, something loaded with more scientific payload that the Plymouth Marine Lab, the Icarus's people could really work with in a more profound way. So we knew we had to do something a little bit bigger. And looking at the history of the original Mayflower in 1620, there were two children that were born on the ship. And so I don't think most people ever think about this, but there were two pregnant women that boarded the ship and crossed the Atlantic in 1620, and along with their compatriots, you need to remember every one of them expected that, or at least calculated it, or knew that it was highly likely they would die on the voyage, or if not on the voyage, very soon after, if they made it. And so I'm always baffled by that people would take that risk, and particularly women in that state. And they had gave birth to two sons. Each woman gave birth to a son, one in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean on Mayflower named Oceanus. And then the second child, when they had just anchored up off Plymouth, Massachusetts, named Peregrine. And so I have another, we're building a little boat for fun for students, and that one's named Peregrine. And the big one that we're doing with Icarus is named after the first child born on Mayflower. So the child of the Mayflower autonomous ship is Oceanus. And of course, in Greek mythology, Oceanus was Titan, the son of Uranus and Gaia. And he was the husband of the Titan Tethys as well. And so it's the ocean god. But really, it's named after the first child born on Mayflower. So we thought that was fitting.
What a story. What a story. And as I was saying, I did a little bit of the research into it. From those descendants, from those two, well, not those two, I think there was 51 that survived once the Mayflower landed. There are now 35 million people, maybe more, in existence today as a result of that one ship sailing from England over to Plymouth.
Well, and I learned something really funny about my family history. So my family goes back quite a way in the eastern part of Canada. But before that, in Massachusetts Bay Colony, actually, and I wasn't on the Mayflower. My family didn't come over on the Mayflower. We came over not long after in the second wave. My furthest back in time relative in the United States we can trace was in 1628 in Lynn, Massachusetts. He had a farm. We've been able to trace it all the way back, and he was actually a Puritan that went over as an indentured servant, indentured to a wealthier family that had established itself on the first voyage across and set up a Plymouth colony. And so he worked his indenture off and then had land and had a farm in 1628. So my forebear, first one in the United States, wasn't on the Mayflower, but was on the second wave. So Oceanus is also close to me in that regard anyway. But yeah, they were Puritans also. So weird. So I'm one of that 35 million that almost, I'm one of the other 90% that almost was related to the first group.
Interestingly enough, there was another ship that was making that trip with the Mayflower, and they kept having to turn back because it was leaking all the time. And they just said, you know what? Forget you. You go back to England. We're heading.
We haven't named anything after the Speedwell yet.
Well, it seems that you wouldn't want to, because obviously it wasn't very successful the first time out.
I do want to name a ship in the future, one of our autonomous vessels. I want to name it the Mary Celeste, because there's no one on it. So that's one of the ones I'm going to do at a later date. But seemed for an uncrewed vessel, that was apropos. I digress.
Hey, Chris, tell me a little bit about this project. What is it? It became an idea in October of 2022, and it's due to finish in 2026. Now, what is the whole concept of this project? What do you hope to achieve? And what kind of information or change do you think it's going to help us achieve in the end?
I suppose the starting point for this, I think a good place to start is the recent news we've had about ocean temperatures. Right? And we've seen that the last year has been the warmest on record for the ocean temperatures. We're now well above the pre-industrial average. And there is some potential that we might be moving into a different state. And we're certainly pushing the boundaries of 1.5% climate change. So the context of those warming oceans has huge impact on the seas, and particularly the biology and ecology and the biogeochemical cycling that goes with that. Now, the ocean itself sits, there is a paucity of data. We've got all this beautiful satellite data on the surface, which is telling us all about the temperature. It's telling us how the ocean is warming, but it doesn't really tell us a huge amount about what's going on below the surface. Now, currently, the technology we use to sample at sea is primarily large research ships. They require people, they're extremely expensive to build and run. They're very limited in capacity as to where they can go. They're not ideally suited for regular sampling and survey. So we don't really have very much of any kind of detailed synoptic picture of what's going on under the surface of the ocean. You've got the surface of the ocean nailed to satellites, but as soon as you go more than a couple of meters down, we've no idea what's going on. So building on the work that Brett and his team had done with Mayflower, we were really looking at how can we make the next step technologically to build a vessel that is scalable, doesn't require people, can be loaded up with large quantities of autonomous measurement in a way that we can just essentially put these things out to sea, sample as many things as we can using autonomous state-of-the-art sensors and telemetry backs. For the cost of building large research vessels, you could instead build a fleet of these much smaller independent vessels, which you could then propagate across the ocean. Right? So that's where we're coming from with this. And then For many years at Plymouth, we've been running an expedition we call the Atlantic Meridional Transect. So we take a ship once a year, working with British Antarctic Survey, from the UK to the South Atlantic, usually from the UK to the Falklands. And we've, for 25 years and over 30 expeditions, have been collecting near surface and top 200 meter data as a transect of the Atlantic. So the exam question we set ourselves with Oceanus was really, could we build a vessel that could replicate that voyage, so from Plymouth to the Falkland Islands, without actually, you know, without having anyone on board, so that we could ultimately automate that. So that's the sort of exam, scientific exam question, technological exam question we set ourselves. And we want to build this vessel and make that voyage as a proof of concept to show how we could revolutionize the sampling of the top 100, 200 meters of the ocean on a global scale.
Well, in your last project, all of the data that was coming up was readily available to the public as it came up. Is that the same with it?
Of course, yes. It's absolutely essential that data is made freely available and put in the public domain. It's a mandatory requirement anyway for research organizations funded by government. But it's something that needs to be done. The data has to be collected for public good on a global scale and should be accessible to everybody to use it in the best way that they can.
Now, and once you gather all this information and the project is finished, what will this data enable you to do? What changes will this data give you the opportunity to make?
It's looking at, we're proposing to collect data that would allow you to look at lots of things. Firstly, you'd be able to assess the heat content of the surface ocean. You would be looking at the planktonic communities in the upper ocean, using underway optical sensors, measuring the chlorophyll, taking pictures and analyzing plankton using artificial intelligence. You combine that data with measurements of carbon and nutrients, which give you an understanding of the surface ocean carbon cycle. If you understand the plankton community structure, you can start to take samples of things like zooplankton and eDNA, so we can look at what the rest of the ecosystem is doing and how it's evolving. We can measure the climatically active gases in the ocean. We can measure the transfer of those gases into the atmosphere, not just carbon dioxide, but also things like dimethyl sulfide, nitrous oxide, and methane. So there's a whole range of things that we can look at that key into the essential services provided by the ocean. So the ocean as a heat sink, the ocean as a source of oxygen, the ocean as a source of food, the ocean as a source of biodiversity, and it gives us synoptic pictures in close to real time of the state of the surface ocean. And over time, as you keep building vessels and deploying them, you build up a detailed time series of the surface ocean in a way that we currently don't have. And if you have that kind of data, you can then analyze it, you can bring it all together, get much better understanding of the processes of how the ocean works, and use that to infer with models how it may evolve in the future.
And let me ask you, how fragile is the ecosystem in the ocean? For example, the plankton disappeared. How would that affect the entire system all the way up to land and human survival?
Plankton, an enormous part of the oxygen, right? The primary production by marine plankton is a major source of oxygen into the atmosphere. So clearly without plankton, you'd lose that source of oxygen, which would make terrestrial life somewhat challenging. It would be the understatement. The plankton is also the base of marine food. So if you have reductions in the amount of plankton, or indeed changes in community structure, this propagates in terms of the food that's available and the quality of food that's available all the way up the food chain. So this then impacts on zooplankton, impacts on fish, impacts on marine mammals, impacts on seabirds, and impacts on humans in terms of the capture fisheries that we undertake. Right, it's a major source of protein for many coastal communities, particularly in the developing world. So losses, the total loss of plankton is not going to happen. but shifts in the plankton community structure and shifts in its health will have big impacts. It also affects the ability of the ocean to absorb carbon, draw carbon down, and export it long-term into the deep ocean. And it's a multifaceted and complex system, but with huge vulnerabilities.
But that's why that's the key. It's a multifaceted, complex system that we're barely able to wrap our mind around now. We had a data glut, and now we're just starting to get the tools available to process the ever-increasing volume of data. And so we're creating information at an unprecedented rate. And what we need to focus on now is not only getting more data and creating information at the edge that's actionable more quickly, but then integrating that more broadly into a context that people can relate to and act upon. And that is the epic challenge, I think, and for humanity. And of course, Oceanus, in my mind, is the tip of the spear, right? It's this is how we're going to do it. We're not just going to aggregate it somewhere. We're going to get it. We're going to process it at the edge. We're going to move that as information back. We're going to integrate that information into the corpus of knowledge so that when we do send people to sea or to space, for that matter, which I increasingly see no distinction between ocean science happening in below, on, or in the upper atmosphere or in space. It's all integrated now, planetary sciences. We need to be able to bring that to people in a way that they can comprehend. And that's a huge challenge. Anyway, I'm off topic. I'm focused on my little aspect of it, which is the tools to do it.
So, yeah, that was my next question. That is one of the things that I do notice, is that in when you're watching mainstream news or talking in conversation with other people, they're more worried about going down to the beach and saying, oh, wow, this is great. The water's so much warmer than it used to be. But realistically, you can show them as many figures as you want. But until you explain to them the effect of what that warmer water is at their local beach and how it's actually affecting not only the ocean ecosystem, but how it's going to eventually affect us as human beings, that I think is the key. And that is the struggle that we have when we have a lot of data, is trying to get that message across.
And it's hard to cut through the hyperbole. That's the other thing. Like, I'm really getting tired of terms using apocalypse as a suffix. Or not, it makes me think, first, I don't think people actually know what the word apocalypse means, because if there was one, we wouldn't have to be concerned with 100 or 1,000 years from now. But then the hyperbole makes it hard to act, because when you have people telling you, oh, we're all going to be dead in 10 years or we'll all die in 12 years, it's like, okay, no, that isn't going to happen. But if we could just all calm down and focus more on learning a little bit about science, maybe the time testing is, protest is fine, but uneducated protest doesn't help. What we need is people to understand that there are both anthropomorphic processes that are causing acceleration in the natural process of the cyclical heating and cooling of the earth, and that hyperbole will do only one thing: prevent us from preparing for what will happen. And if it happens faster than it should naturally, that of course is bad, but we still need to prepare. And you do that through reason, not through terror. Anyway, sorry, you were going to ask me a question, Maria.
No, what you said is fascinating, and I completely agree. When people hear the word apocalypse, they imagine like zombie movies and these big productions out of Hollywood where the world is on fire and everything is falling apart. But that's not actually the reality of it. It's more of a long, drawn-out process. It's not going to one day, we're going to wake up and it's going to be the apocalypse.
And it's going to be miserable. That's the whole point. But it doesn't have to be, right? Things may get hard. But humanity is defined by its adaptability, if nothing else. And so I think understanding how all these things actually work and knowing, having some bounded reality about the way we can act, what we can affect, will help us to structure society and teach in a way that lets us actually survive. But I was watching the other day, there was a person speaking on about, oh, we're going to launch a solar sail into space and we're going to place it in orbit between the Earth and the sun, and when it block out 5% of the sun's radiation from the planet so that it cools. What a horribly bad idea. Presupposing that we knew enough about planetary dynamics that this would make sense, and not say, oh, I don't know, kill all life on the planet, which is a really probable result from hyperbolic overreaction and hysteria. Even if they're not serious, what they are doing is distracting everyone and then starting up companies and suckering people into investing in nonsense that actually overall detracts from anything reasoned we could do to actually preserve and improve life in general on the planet for the longest amount of time. Anyway, sorry, I'm all up.
No, it's fascinating. I love speaking to people like you because it gives a broader view. And especially when it isn't your field, sometimes you don't. No matter how much research you do, sometimes you don't know the right questions to ask to get the kind of information that would be of interest to the general population. So I encourage you to continue to go off topic because I'm learning something as we go. Yep. What is your role, Brett, within this project?
Oh, my role, I had a bad idea and I thought we needed to do something that next step on. And so I generated the idea in meeting with Icarus, because PML worked with us on Mayflower and we do a lot of work with them together because we're in there in Plymouth. And there's our institution of choice with whom to work for marine science. And so we tend to focus on the development of tools and technology and the deployment of advanced autonomous systems. And so they're the perfect uptake for that because they also have a parallel program that is more focused on data processing, creation of information from deployed sensors. Tell me if I'm wrong on that, Icarus.
That's right. Yeah.
And so I'm the bus driver. I'm going to produce the bus that takes the smart people sensors to sea. And my interest in it, I'm trained as an oceanographer and I'm profoundly interested in ocean science and climatological issues, but my passion these days is the development of sophisticated, near-human capable autonomous systems, and particularly in the marine domain. And so I focus what I'm going to learn, the information that I get, the data and the information that I get, that my group gets, that we want to share, is that, well, how do you do it? Like, what do you really need? What are the compute resources? What does it cost? How long does it take to develop? How robust and resilient are they? How safe are they? How ethical are the systems that drive the boat around? And at the end of the day, the vessel itself is just a wrapper around all of that smart stuff. And so that's the part that fascinates me. So I'm coordinating the design and the development of the ship and the integration of the instruments and its operation.
Yep.
And when will this vessel be complete?
26, we should have it floating around doing things. We're still raising money. We've got the design in progress. We've selected a builder for the hull, and we're just going through a little bit more on an iterative design spiral before we start laying up pieces of it's going to be aluminum. Because we're learning more every day because we operate other vehicles in the sea that are much smaller, but still large by, like, compared to what other people do. And the AI systems continue to improve rapidly, so the capability of the vessel starts to expand in ways that are unexpected. So I'd say summer 26, if not earlier, we'll be driving out of Plymouth Sound on extensive sea trials in the North Atlantic.
Do you think this project, once finalized, will be something that others can take from and create into, say, for example, autonomous shipping?
Hope so. The commercial uptake for this stuff hasn't quite figured it out yet. So when you look at, so the military spends a lot of money on autonomy because they have a different source of funding and a different need. And then, so they largely drive the direction of the technology. And then when you look at the shipping industry, and this is something funny, most people don't realize this, but pretty much every human is dependent on international shipping. And if you own something that you bought somewhere, it's pretty high chance in the 90%+ that it was on a ship at some point in its transit. And so we depend on it. We depend on it for food. We depend on it for everything you can imagine is maritime activity. But when you look at things like multi-billion dollar container ships, the crew itself is small by comparison to the tonnage. And they also don't represent a huge cost savings to remove and the ships are already highly automated, which is different than autonomy. And so there's not an uptake there. But short-haul shipping, where you're getting things off the road as opposed to going over the land, you're going over the sea, maybe 50, 100, 200 miles, that is starting to emerge now. Renewable-powered ships, so we're seeing a return to the age of sail for slow cargo as opposed to, because we live in a world where everything has to go fast. But if you're only going 150 or 200 miles, it doesn't matter if you go 5 or 6 knots as opposed to 50 or 60 knots. So we have to rethink the way we structure our economy and where the economic uptake in autonomy makes sense. And in the very, very small vessels, you can't compete because they operate for what's called just their OPEX, meaning they're already fully capitalized and amortized, and then they operate the vessel just for the bare cost. So there's safety-related issues where removing people from sea makes more sense. I think you'll see a hybridization of, like, not fully autonomous, but a minimally crewed ships that are aided by AI, sophisticated AI systems, which poses a bizarre ethical dilemma, which is if you never let the human drive the ship, then the human loses proficiency, which means even in the best of cases, the decision-making processes of the AI isn't explainable because you lack the context to query it. And so ethically, you have to start building these systems to require humans to maintain their own proficiency, to be a partner. So instead of us training the AI, we're going to have to depend in the future on the AI's training us to maintain basic proficiency, which is a really weird switch. So all that stuff squishy. And the two places where things are moving forward the fastest is really autonomy in the marine research and space-based research systems and in the military. And so, and they do it for different reasons, but they often drive very similar technological results. So it's interesting to keep an eye on both, because you can not steal, you can borrow the best of ideas to put something together that serves a higher purpose. So I don't know what the economics of it will be, but it's, I'm not sure there's a higher purpose than understanding climate dynamics, whether you want to consider economic impacts in that or not. It would be hard to understate it, to overstate it rather.
I think both go hand in hand, because one of the biggest arguments that you're seeing on the face of the planet right now, and especially in the U.S., actually, is that when we're looking at the environmental aspects of our everyday life, there's certain things that need to be cut back. But in general, that means people are comfortable in how they live. And some of them are going to have to make a change in their lifestyle. And human beings don't like making change in any way whatsoever.
Yeah, the longer you wait, the worse the change is going to be.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is the next step for Project Oceanus? What do you need to continue this project? What do you need to make sure that it is completed by 2026?
What do we need? Shall we be gauche? Some money would be nice. We could use some additional sponsorship, both in kind from marine industry, although we have quite a lot of that. Any kind of fiscal contribution to help us on that path would be always appreciated. And then we need, the biggest thing we need is for the regulators not to add any new regulations before we get the ship done, because they're adding regulations all the time from a state of ignorance. They don't really understand it. So they're knee-jerk reacting to it, much the way some people do to changes in climate. And it's a hyperbolic thing. And it's like, okay, it only goes 7 miles an hour. Okay, fine. Not going to chase you down Main Street, right? It's a boat. Right? And can we all take a step back and breathe, and let's figure out how to do this kind of experimentation in the service of marine science with a little bit more sobriety than hyperbole. And that would be a good thing. So in-kind donation, capital donations, and then a negative, don't add any more regulation. Those are the three things I need. I don't know.
And then from the science point of view, I think it's around, a lot of it's around sensor development and testing.
Yep.
There's a whole range of sensors that we have and methods that we use, which are, well, there's quite a lot of stuff that's sort of semi-autonomous that can be run for long periods of time, but still needs human oversight. And really, we're looking at trying to work and develop these systems and actually using local vessels, buoys and large research vessels as a trial for testing various sensors, things like measuring ocean carbon content, optical and flow cytometry sensors for plankton and so on, but looking to test these to make sure that they're robust enough that you can put them on the vessel, point it out of Plymouth Harbour, and they'll still be running and giving good data when you get to the Falkland Islands. In a science sense, that's the big challenge. And then the follow-up challenge comes with as we create large data sets is how do we transport them, how do we store them, how do we interpret them? And there's a big role there clearly for data science and particularly, I think, artificial intelligence and machine learning in order to be able to bring data sets together and interpret them.
Yep.
Right. Man, you know what? It sounds really fascinating. I'm looking forward to just watching the progress of this project, and hopefully we'll be able to have you, both of you gentlemen, on again in maybe a year's time, and we can see where it's at that point. Right.
Absolutely agree. We'd love to.
If you are interested in Project Oceanus, we'll provide a link below this interview when it airs. Of course, they've got a great video that explains a lot more possibly than we've talked about here today in pretty pictures. It is the world's first long-range autonomous research vessel. I want to say thank you to Icarus Allen from the Plymouth Marine Laboratory. Thank you for joining us.
Yep. Thank you for the invitation to speak to you.
Of course. And of course, Brett Fenner. Thank you for your time.
Have a great day.
Okay, thank you.
You've been watching another edition of Yacht Crew Vlog right here on Yachting International Radio. My name is Rio. I have been your host. We'll see you again next time.